confession, I believe that I may have the perfect socks for today's episode. There's some socks that a friend of mine got me from his travels in Japan, and they have separations in the fabric for the toes. I feel much more agile than I would be wearing just normal socks.
Ben, so they're like ninja socks?
Yeah, that's a way to put them. Yeah, it's like the division for the sandals. Picture every Western film you've seen in the 90s or something that featured ninjas.
Right.
Yeah, so I've got these... It's weird. I took my shoes off and showed you and our super producer, Casey Pegram, these socks before we hit the air. I feel somewhat more athletic in these.
Well, Ben, we are in a tiny shipping container type box. Did you put your shoes back on?
Yeah, you can tell, Noel. You can tell that I put my shoes back on. I think being in a small area with your shoes off like that in a work environment, it'd be kind of rude.
No, it's poor podcast etiquette, to be sure.
Like, yeah, like loudly eating or something.
Oh my gosh, Ben, are you being passive aggressive to me about my loud on mic eating?
No, you're not eating something.
I'm not right now, but you know, I've been known to have a snack occasionally, but I try to do it off mic.
Do it when we're not on air.
That's true. Yeah. That's a good point. Although I gotta say, sometimes I find it charming when a podcaster has a little snack on there. I think it's about personal choice.
Okay.
Personal preference.
So back to this idea. I am not a professional athlete, and you and I know each other pretty well. You are currently not a professional athlete.
No, I'm barely a professional anything.
We're barely professional podcasters, right?
I actually updated my Instagram bio to be a semi-pro podcast geek. So that's what I consider myself, semi-pro.
There you go. We do know that the world of professional athleticism is obviously an enormous deal. It's a huge industry. Billions and billions of dollars are spent every year, and billions of dollars are generated every year through various athletic endeavors around the world. And for a peek behind the curtain, as the three of us record today's episode of Ridiculous History, we are on the verge of two very big and unusual things for our fair metropolis of Atlanta. The first is a definite, that's the Super Bowl, and the second is a possible storm, a snowstorm.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking for the snowpocalypse Super Bowl traffic jam coming our way pretty soon.
Right, which became a Facebook event that a lot of people in town checked in on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you do that?
Not yet.
So we started thinking about the world of professional athletes. And we kicked around the idea of maybe doing the history of Super Bowls, which could be a cool notion for a future episode. But we also asked ourselves a surprisingly fascinating question. Who was the highest paid athlete, not just this year, but in history?
Yeah, it's true. And it turns out that somebody else, someone with a little bit more of a historical pedigree than we have, a guy by the name of Dr. Peter Strzok, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. In an article he wrote for Laffam's Quarterly, Strzok went into great detail about his discovery that turns out the highest paid athlete of all time was not like a footballer or a basketballer.
It wasn't LeBron.
It wasn't
Tiger.
Wasn't some football player.
Wasn't Michael Jordan. Wasn't Joe Montana.
Joe Montana?
That's a football player.
That's true. I remember him from video games mainly.
I like he was known for his effective but just very ugly throws.
But he had a big old arm, right? He was like an arm guy.
Most of them do. There are very few.
That's true. We got a Peyton Manning. He's a good
example.
There
we go.
He's worth a lot of money.
And Tiny Arm Jenkins.
Tiny Arm Jenkins and then the refrigerator. But no, none of those guys. Turns out it was I'm going to say, charioteer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a charioteer named Gaius Apuleius Diocles.
Well done.
We'll probably shift around in that pronunciation times. This is a very, very interesting guy. He was from an area of what is now modern-day Spain and Portugal. He was most likely illiterate, but man, his chariot game was on fire. So there's an inscription set up in the city of Rome that was originally created in 146 CE or AD, however you prefer, and it tells us exactly how much this charioteer from the province of Lusitania earned during his, oh, what was it, Noel, 24 years as an athlete, as a charioteer?
Yes, and let's not sweep under the rug the fact that that is an awful long time to survive in such a intense and brutal and strenuous and dangerous for even spectators, let alone the people right in the thick of it, profession. I mean, we're talking like these chariots being drawn by up to 10 horses. He had like the reins tied around his waist. You know, I mean, I could imagine a mishap, you know, tearing him limb from limb. But he was able to maintain this career 24 years, which is, oh gosh, at least four times the length, I would say, of an average, you know, football or basketball player's career.
Yeah, even in these, our modern days, ongoing studies show us that being an athlete can be tremendously damaging to the body and punishing to the mind, especially when you get in the world of boxing and U.S. football, which, you know, leave the door wide open to concussions.
Yeah, you know, and I just kind of pulled that out of my ear, but it's about, apparently, according to Business Insider, the average span of an NBA basketball player is about 4.8 years.
Right, right. It's true. It's now, this can be longer for some individuals, and of course, it can be longer in some sports, mm-hmm. right? Some Olympic sports, you may have a longer lifespan, but professionally speaking, again, we are at our best only human. So this guy is doing a tremendous job back in his time. As a charioteer, Noel, what exactly would his sport have been comprised of?
Well, like I said, he would have been piloting a two-wheeled chariot, right? How many wheels are on a chariot? Is it four? I picture it as being reared back on two wheels. Two wheels with a team of horses, like I said, up to 10, reins used to kind of encourage them to go faster or slow up. And like I said, he actually had them tied around his body so he could use his whole body to kind of control the horses.
And he was racing. This is racing.
Yeah.
Specifically.
And dirty tricks in chariot racing. I guess I think of maybe cartoon examples of chariot racing where all of a sudden, and like one of the wheels would have like a blade on it or something like that, and they'd kind of go up close to the other participant and use that blade to kind of grind up at their wheel. And I think people would stop at nothing to defeat the competition no matter what it took, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And chariot racing was a huge, huge deal. It was bigger than NASCAR is now. The classes would be divided primarily by how many horses were pulling the chariot, a two-horse team, a four-horse team, a six-horse team. The earliest account of a chariot race occurs in Homer's description of the funeral of Patroclus. These races were one of the big-ticket items of the ancient Olympic Games. They would happen during religious festivals. Essentially, civilizations at the time viewed chariot races as a really cool thing to add to almost any public event. You know what I mean? It's like a city-wide festival or contest. And normally, these chariot races would proceed thusly. There would be 4 to 6 different chariots. They would compete in a single race, and the race would usually be around 7 laps around what was called the Circus Maximus. These chariots, we should emphasize, were very light affairs because, you know, you wanted to get the maximum power and the minimum amount of weight. This also means that they were super fragile. So were a collision to occur, you were up the wrong creek without a paddle.
Yeah. And to that end, most of the folks that piloted these chariots only lived till about 24 years old, whereas Diocles retired, which is very unusual, at the ripe old age of 42, at which point he was worth a whole lot of money.
Dr. Strzok found that Diocles' total earnings would have equated to roughly $15 billion in modern terms. $15 billion with a B. You can also see another great write-up of this in History Collection. There's an article by Alexander Mettings that we would recommend. This is strange because these were all net earnings too. The charioteer didn't have to pay promoters, didn't have to pay, you know, a marketing team or support his, I don't know, entourage or shell out cash for sponsorship. He probably had it pretty good, you know. What would he have done personally with that? And how did Professor Strzok figure out this number?
On that inscription, Ben, that you mentioned, it has his earnings in the currency of the time, which is sesterce. And that would have been 35,863,120. And Strzok figured out that for the time, that would have been enough to buy grain to feed the entirety of Rome for 1 year, and also was about five times higher a salary than any of the highest paid officials in the land, and also could have paid for every single Roman soldier for a fifth of a year. And that was when Rome was at its peak in terms of its military might.
Yeah, running from Scotland all the way in the far north, Egypt in the south, Spain in the west, and the Euphrates in the east. He clearly busted his hump for this money. And to compare him to, let's say, the highest paid governmental authorities, in 2 months, he would earn what Rome's highest paid provincial governor could expect to earn in 1 year. And there was a great amount of risk with this. We mentioned the horse's reins being tied physically to the athlete. When those fragile vehicles collided with something, it often resulted in the death or serious injury of a charioteer because the horses kept going.
That's right. And there'd be a lot of trampling. And Ben, we were trying to get to the conversion method. We always plug numbers into our handy dandy inflation calculator here on Ridiculous History. But those figures that I mentioned earlier are on the stone inscription, the idea of being able to bankroll the Roman army for a fifth of a year. So Strzok was able to extrapolate a modern estimate based on what it would cost to pay for our military. So it's obviously not a perfect one-to-one, but would have been a pretty good educated guess.
Absolutely. And, oh, you know what we should do? We should read the actual inscription. So here it goes in the English translation. It begins with Gaius Appuleius Diocles, charioteer of the Red Stable, a Lusitanian Spaniard by birth, age 42 years, 7 months, 23 days. And the monument says he raced 4 horse chariots for 24 years. So we get some valuable numbers there. We also know that given his fame, there was a snowball effect. He started turning down races. You know what I mean? It had to be worth his time. So he would race in the most high-end, high-profile races that had the most potential to win a large amount of money. He started in, this is according to the inscription, in 4,257 races. He won 1,463 times. And the inscription says that translates to him winning 92 major prizes. Of these, 32 were of 30,000 sesterce, 3 of them with 6 horse teams, 2 in races with 6 horse chariots, 1 with a 7 horse chariot. He tied with, because they had these different factions, right? He was a Red Stable, right? And he tied a Blue Stable 10 times, a Green Stable 91. And this inscription, the thing that's invaluable about it is that it maps out his stats the same way that a baseball card, back when those were a big deal, a baseball card would map out the stats of your favorite baseball player.
Ben, would these have been like alongside gladiator events, or would those have been like two different things? Because it feels like this would have almost been like a— like the gladiator thing might have been the main event. This might have been like a side event, or were they completely separate? I'm just wondering.
You know, that's a good question. Well, there's probably a situation, again, wherein there were large public events that involved this stuff, and there were definitely chariots in gladiatorial combat at
times.
That's
right. Sometimes there could have been probably gladiator matches on chariot, where they're like coming at each other, swinging weapons as they pass, right?
Mm-hmm. So let's go back for a second to the earlier comparison in the world of animation and cartoons, right? How exaggerated or how accurate was this depiction of chariot racing? it turns out that it's not completely off base. It's not completely cartoonish or made up, because these knives on the wheels were a real thing, and the charioteers would attempt to ram their rivals into the median at the center of the track, called the spinae. And then they would come crashing into these hairpin turns. They also, I thought you would find just the pure spectacle of this fascinating. During races, it was very common for the three chariots representing each faction to team up with one another to bring down a very unpopular rival or a very strong one, like Diocles. And bring down in this sense means literally grind them into the dust. This violence is part of why chariot races were so incredibly popular. Like, think about how many people love the Super Bowl. I'm sure there's an income bracket to get a ticket, because those things are thousands of dollars. But millions and millions of people in this country watch the Super Bowl and pull for a team they love, regardless of, you know, their individual demographic. Chariot races were the same way, but before television.
That's true. And you could also probably expect to see someone get really horribly injured, you know, and ideally that's less the case with modern American football, or they're trying to phase that out and make it less of an attraction. But I still think that's largely what people, not to like taste blood, but you, it's all about the stakes, right? What's the point of like being all in with this if there aren't like real stakes? You don't feel like these people have something to lose beyond just like glory or being shamed or whatever.
That's a great question. I wrote a thing a long time ago that wasn't part of How Stuff Works, about the social role of sports as a substitute for actual warfare. It hits all the same notes of tribalism, you know what I mean? And identifying with something larger than oneself. This is making me miss car stuff, Noel, because we have to mention these chariot races were also dangerous for the audience, because the rivalry went beyond lighthearted competition. It became as high risk as the races themselves. Think of soccer hooligans, okay? There were chariot hooligans, charioteer hooligans. One guy learned about the death of one of the best charioteers in the Red Faction, and he threw himself on the funeral pyre to be burned alongside his sports idol.
Dude, that's like sports as a stand-in for not only warfare, but like religion.
Yeah. Good call. In 69 AD or CE, the Emperor Vitellius had some commoners executed because they talked trash about the Blue Faction, and the Emperor loved them. He was personally offended, so he had them put to death.
And it also reminds me of sort of the early days of auto racing, like the Le Mans. Remember we did an episode on that where it was absolutely very dangerous just physically to be a spectator, because if there was a fiery crash, bits of flaming debris could go shooting out into the crowd, potentially injuring or even killing people. There were several accounts of folks being killed at those races, and such is the case for these chariot races. You know, you'd have the potential for people in the stands getting hit by, you know, pieces of flying off of the chariots and stuff.
Oh, yeah, the 24-hour Le Mans. Yeah, we have a ridiculous history on that. We have something about the history of the race in a series on car stuff, too. If you'd like to learn more about the, oh, my gosh, the utterly horrific accidents that happened in those races. We have to say, you know, we have to speculate a bit on the psychology of the audience, because maybe that was part of the appeal, to be right down there in the thick of it, as close to the chariots as possible, despite the risk, or to have this social identification that was so strong that you would want to physically harm someone because they were a green and you were a blue. It's strange, too, because Diocles was chasing glory along with money, but he was definitely chasing the glory, chasing the fame, because he switched his factions. He began his career as a white, and then he moved over to the greens because of all the teams, the greens and the blues were the most successful and the most popular, right? And think of them like the New England Patriots if you're a football fan. But then he made a switcheroo, a plot twist. You see, he transferred to the less popular Red faction, and this would have made pretty good financial sense to him, maybe have given him some more time to shine. He would have been a bigger fish in a smaller pond. Because you see, Diocles, when he was on the Green Team, he was just one of many very popular charioteers, you know. He was possibly a footnote in history, but he could become a main character in history if he went with the Reds. And that's what he did. And despite what you might assume, he was not the charioteer who won the most races. He just got the most money. As Professor Robert B. Kiebrick points out in The Career of Diocles, Roman Charioteer, his victories paled in comparison to those of other charioteers such as Scorpius, who had 2,048 victories, or Pompeius Musculus, who had 3,559 victories. But he made it. He won the game, right? He retired, as we said. He lived a pretty sedate, fun life after that, you know, from... Let's see, he was born in approximately 104 CE, and he passed away sometime after 146 CE. But I believe his death was relatively, I don't know, peaceful or unremarked upon.
Yeah, especially given the profession, right? So by that point, I think it was just kind of unusual for anyone in such a violent, inherently violent line of work to be able to retire. And even though he didn't win the most, maybe that's because he was playing the long game, right, Ben? I mean, he was like protecting himself and maybe not being quite as reckless, but he certainly knew how to show off and have some flourishes. He had his own signature style, almost like, you know, Tiger style or like something out of like a Street Fighter game. And it was called the Strong Final Dash.
Oh, nice.
Because he could just pull out all the stops. And then that maybe means he would bide his time a little bit and stay out of harm's way and, like, protect himself. But then at the end, he would, like, come up and ahead of the pack. But, yeah, it's crazy, man, that he was able to just relaxingly drift away as an old man of, what was he, like, 50 years old?
He passed away on his estate in the Italian countryside near modern-day Palestrina, and he lived out the remainder of his days in a quiet life, living the quiet life. You know, he had a son and a daughter who later erected a memorial to him at the site. And there he remains in history as the highest paid athlete of all time. But you know what? My spidey sense is telling me that several of our fellow ridiculous historians are having a come on, you guys moment when you say, okay, so Diocles was really ballin' back in the days of ancient Rome, but who is the world's highest paid athlete now? It turns out we do have the answer, or an answer, because some of this depends on how you calculate it. Casey, help us out with a drum roll here, if you would be so kind. The highest paid athlete in the modern world is...
It's Floyd Mayweather. Who's an American boxer, problematic figure. He's gotten some trouble with the law, but he's managed to exceed the total of the other of himself and the other two top earning athletes in the world, who are LeBron James, Lionel Messi, and Cristiano Ronaldo. And that those three had a combined earning total of $259 million for a season's worth of work.
Yeah, yeah.
And that also includes like endorsements and partnerships and things like that. And this is reported by Forbes magazine. But Mayweather knocked all of that out of the water with something that happened very recently, right?
That's correct. That's correct. He earned the top spot, you said, a little north of 250 mil total for those other three. Between June 1st, 2017 and June 1st, 2018, Floyd Mayweather earned $275 million. This comes to us from a greatmoney.com article by Mike Ayers. Here's the kicker. He earned that not across the year. He earned that for one night of work when he fought Conor McGregor on August 27th, 2018. Add in his total $10 million worth of additional endorsements, and we get up to $285 million. This is not his first time topping the list. He has topped it four times in the last 7 years. Of course, that's quite a princely sum, but all the money in the world, still with our current level of medical technology, will not help you fully recover from decades of brutal concussions.
It's true.
So you win some, you lose some. And at this point, still, according to Dr. Strzok, no one has beaten the record that Diocles the Charioteer established way back in ancient Rome. Makes you think, would you do a chariot race?
No, man. The two-wheel thing freaks me out.
I would totally do it.
You would just, it seems like it'd be so easy to flip over. Those horses have to counterbalance the whole time. And if you lose the slack on the reins, it seems like your whole front end would go into the dirt. Or if they reared up a little too much, you'd flip over backwards. It just seems like a fool's errand to me, sir.
I see where you're coming from. To each their own. I think it would be a lot of fun. So if you know where I could just ride some chariots around, please let me know. You can hit us on our Facebook group, Ridiculous Historians. You can hit me up on Instagram directly at Ben Boland.
Surely there's some kind of chariot simulator you could try before jumping full bore into the Circus Maximus.
I want to go for the gusto, man.
All right, man. I respect that. I really do. You can check me out on Instagram at Embryonic Insider. And Ben, I think you had a comic recommendation today.
I do have a comic recommendation today. I am a fan of a comic series called Britannia, which studies the story of someone named Antonius Axia, the Empire's finest, you'll love this word, folks, detectioner. He is applying scientific scrutiny and rational thought to various mysteries, usually mysteries that he is tasked with solving by the mad emperor Nero. It's a great read. It's highly recommended. Let us know if you've read it and what you think about it. In the meantime, of course, thank you for checking out today's show. And thank you to Casey Pegram, as always.
Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Thanks to our amazing research associate, Gabe. And thanks to you, Ben Bolin, my friend.
Hey, thanks to you, Noel Brown.
I got a question for you. Is this this comic recommendation is sort of an alternate historical account, kind of like Manifest Destiny or one of those kind of deals?
Without all of the tinges of supernatural stuff. It's a mystery comic, and I think
sounds like a winner.
It's well done. Let us know what you think.
And please be sure and join us for the next episode of Ridiculous History. See you next time.